Last time, the beginning of chapter 36 for today. Can't see everybody. I guess I don't see any hands up. Chapter 36, I'm going to really almost skip, except just to mention a couple of three things in passing. This is the genealogical table of Esau and all of his progeny. And I want you to notice a couple of interesting things in connection with the book of Obadiah. I won't turn to that. But notice it says in verse 1, these are the generations of Esau, who is Edom. Esau, of course, is Jacob's brother, who was the elder and should have had the birthright, but we know the subterfuge that occurred and how it was that God allowed that to happen because he wanted Jacob to inherit the promise that had come to Abraham and Isaac and not Esau. Esau, it says, who is Edom, verse 1. It also says that in verse 8, thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. So when you read of Edom and Ammon and Moab and all these nations that were generated to the east of Israel, you know that Esau is a son of Abraham and is not a Canaanite, is not a different stock at all, but is a son of Abraham and of Abraham through, of course, Sarah. And not just necessarily, Sarah, but I mean on down to Isaac, and therefore was not of Keturah and is a very close relative of his brother Jacob. Esau is found in the modern nation of Turkey. And notice some of the names you run across. Verse 11, the sons of Eliphaz, and Eliphaz was the son of Ada, the wife of Esau, Reuel. The sons of Bashemath, the wife of Esau. The sons of Eliphaz, verse 11, were Teman, Omar, Zepho, and Gatam, and Kenaz. Now Kenaz, Omar, and Teman will appear many times. Verse 15, these were the dukes of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Teman, Duke Omar, and so on. Now you come to verse 34 and notice, Jobab died, and Husham of the land of Temani reigned in his stead. And just like today, people name lands and they name inheritances and buildings and institutions after themselves. It was no different then. And if you look in the book of Obadiah, you're going to find the one who came with the garments dipped in blood from Teman or Temani, and you see the prophecy of how Esau stood in the way when his brother Jacob was in a position of captivity. It shows that the Turks are going to turn upon the nation of Israel and very likely even many people of the British and the American race at the last moment at the beginning of World War III. And I think that it is traditional with the Turks that they have always tended to cooperate with the enemies of Britain and America, and then at the last minute, when it swings the opposite direction, they turn real quickly. They did that in World War I, they did it in World War II. Let's go on to the next chapter, chapter 37. Jacob dwelt in the land wherein his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. These are the generations of Jacob, and now it begins reading about Joseph, being 17, was feeding the flock with his brethren, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah, and with the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives, and Joseph brought unto their father, or his father, their evil report. Now Israel, meaning Jacob, his name has now been changed, loved Joseph more than all of his children, because he was the son of his old age. And he made him a coat of many colors. Now actually it should read a garment, a colored garment with sleeves. The colors mean more than just the fact that it was a beautiful coat. By this time, tribal stripes and colors were being adopted by different of these sons, and I suspect that the coat was also indicative of the fact that his father, Israel, was indicating that Joseph was the one to whom the blessings of Abraham and Isaac were to pass. It goes on to say that there were dreams that were given, and God certainly gave him these dreams that showed that this was to be so. When his brethren saw that his father, their father, loved him more than all his brethren, they hated him and could not speak peaceably unto him. And Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brethren, and they hated him yet the more. And he said, "Hear, I pray you, the dream which I have dreamed." Now they were on up into their 40s, 50s, some of them 60s or whatnot. Here he is, 17. And all the other children, Issachar, Gad, Zebulun, Naphtali, Dan, Reuben, Simeon, Judah, Levi, and so on, are much older. They've come along earlier now, much, much later. And Israel or Jacob is very elderly. Along comes a baby boy 17 years ago and is, of course, the favorite. So he said, "We were binding sheaves in the field, and lo, my sheaf arose and also stood upright. And behold, your sheaves stood round about and made obeisance to my sheaf. And his brethren said to him, Shall you indeed reign over us, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? And they hated him yet the more for his dreams and for his words. Interesting that the other brothers allied together against Joseph. That is fairly common in families. In a large extent, in my own family, I had similar problems, and it was not until we were really mature young men that my brother and I really did have the really great, deep, and loving relationship we should have had, because there were always certain tensions and jealousies that were there. I was the son that came along that was not expected, and very late in time, my father and mother were 38 when I was born, and so on. And it sometimes is that way in families, that the younger one, and when the parents are older, the parents will tend to spoil that child. The first child, when parents are young, they'll be pretty rigid, pretty hard on them. And then the next one, the same thing. And when you have large families, five or six kids, and by the time the last one comes along, tag in Charlie or the caboose of the family, and the parents are up in their late 30s or early 40s, by the time that child is about 6 or 8 or 10, they just spoil him to death. Well, they start spoiling him to death all the way from babyhood, and they start to tend to treat that child more like a grandparent would than a parent. And there's a difference. And so sometimes they spoil, as we say, they spoil these kids rotten. Well, he dreamed yet another dream and told it to his brethren and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream more. And behold, the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars made obeisance to me. And he told it to his father and to his brethren, and his father rebuked him and said unto him, What is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall I and your mother and thy brethren indeed come to bow down ourselves to thee in the earth? So he was becoming a little bit obnoxious, even to his father, who had favored him with an outpouring of love and affection, and of course the coat, which might have been symbolic. And his brethren envied him, and his father observed the saying. So his father was being a little cautious. He thought, now wait a minute, you know, is this really true? Is the kid making it up? Did he really dream that? Is he saying that even I and his own mother are going to bow down to him? I mean, the kid's gall is unlimited. And so the whole family was really beginning to react to it. And his brethren went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. Remember, we'd learned a few chapters earlier how Shechem and the others were killed, and it was the land that the Israelites had taken over as a result of the action of Simeon and Levi when they caused the men to be circumcised and hacked them all to death, and of course took their families and flocks and inherited their property. And Israel said unto Joseph, Do not your brethren feed the flock in Shechem. Come, and I will send thee unto them. And he said, Here am I. He said to him, Go, I pray thee, see whether it be well with thy brethren and well with the flocks, and bring me word again. So he went out of the vale of Hebron, came to Shechem. He found a certain man who was wandering in the field. A man said, Who do you look for? And he said, I'm looking for my brethren. He said, They're not here. Let us go to Dothan. So he went and found them in Dothan, verse 17. And when they saw him afar off, maybe he was in a plain and way distant, a couple of miles away, they saw a figure walking toward them, and they began to conspire against him to slay him. And they said one to another, Behold, this master of dreams, as the margin says, this dreamer comes. Come now, therefore, and let us slay him, and cast him into some pit, and we will say some evil beast has devoured him, and we shall see what will become of his dreams. An incredible story that flesh and blood brothers can grow to hate one another, and can be so envious and so jealous that they will actually plot and conspire to murder their own flesh and blood. But remember, this was a polygamous family. Remember that these were the sons of, Zilpah, and Bilhah, and not even of the two wives, but of the two handmaids, and that it was a polygamous family of four mothers, and that may have had a lot to do with it as well. So they were not really from the same mother as was Joseph, and therefore, in a sense, only half-brothers. But still, it's rather an incredible story about human nature. And Reuben heard it, and he delivered them, or him, out of their hands, and said, Let us not kill him. I find that fascinating, especially since I think, I'm not positive, that Reuben is found in the nation of France, the French people, today. And I think that there's some interesting things down through history that have happened between these brethren, these brother nations, that might bear some explanation. For example, the greatest symbol with which we're familiar of liberty and of freedom in the entire world is what? When you enter New York Harbor, the very symbol of America is the Statue of Liberty. Well, that was a gift from our brother France. It was designed and it was sent over here and built, of course, piece by piece and bit by bit, by the French people. And a smaller model of that does exist in Paris. So it was a gift of Reuben. And you also look at the Louisiana Purchase, and you look at what happened in the darkest days of the Napoleonic Wars, where the United States was, in a sense, cooperating with some of these nations, and really straddling the fence and cooperating with both nations, such as England and France, at the same time. But Reuben, who might just be basically the northern part of the French people, not necessarily the southern, certainly not Basques, but the more white European French-speaking people, said, "Let us not kill him." And Reuben said unto them, "Shed no blood, but cast him into the pit that is in the wilderness." So you begin to notice the characteristics of some of these people coming out. "And lay no hand upon him, that he might rid him out of their hands and deliver him to his father again." So Reuben plotted that he could go back later and pull him up out of this pit and maybe spirit him away from these other brothers and get him back to his father. It came to pass when Joseph was coming to his brethren that they stripped Joseph out of his coat of many colors that was on him. Obviously, they just grabbed him and wrestled him to the ground. A whole group of them overpowered him and took him and cast him into a pit. Now, it might have been just simply a natural phenomenon. It might have been something they dug. It was empty. There was no water in it, just a dry area, but it must have been so steep, so precipitous that he couldn't climb out. And they sat down to eat bread and lifted up their eyes and looked, and behold, a company of Ishmaelites came from Gilead with their camels bearing spicery and balm and myrrh, going to carry it down to Egypt. And Judah said unto his brethren, "What profit is it if we slay our brother and conceal his blood? Come and let us sell him." Remarkable that the very first time you see a kidnapping of a half-brother and where people are plotting murder, here comes Judah. You can almost hear him saying, "Oy vey, what profit is it if you slay a brother? Let's sell him. Make a little money, you know." I shouldn't say that, but I'm just kidding. But Judah pipes up and says, "What profit is it?" I find that fascinating. The first thing Judah thought about is, where's the profit in it, you know? And it's a kind of a characteristic that has gotten those people in trouble down through the centuries. "Come and let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother and our flesh." So there was the good part there too, you know. He was looking at making a profit, but he too, just like Reuben, didn't want to kill the man. But really the worst case is that here is a brother who is willing to sell another brother into slavery, actually sell a human being into slavery who is his own half-brother, as it is. "And there passed by Midianites, merchantmen, and they drew and lifted up Joseph out of the pit and sold Joseph to the Ishmaelites for 20 pieces of silver, and they brought Joseph into Egypt. And Reuben returned unto the pit, and behold, Joseph was not in the pit, and he rent his clothes and returned unto his brethren and said, 'The child is not, and I, whither shall I go?'" Meaning, where shall I go to look for him? Apparently, Reuben didn't even know what they had done at this point in time. He was away, perhaps with a different part of the flock at a distant area, came back, discovered that Joseph was gone, and didn't know what in the world the other men had done. So they took Joseph's coat, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the coat in the blood, and sent the coat of many colors, and brought it to their father, and said, "This have we found. We don't know whether it be your son's coat or not." And he knew it, and said, "It is my son's coat. An evil beast has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt rent in pieces." And Jacob rent his clothes and put sackcloth upon his loins and mourned for his son many days. Now you see, out of Joseph is going to come Ephraim and Manasseh. And in them is going to finally be fulfilled the promise of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob when we see at the end of the book, aged old Israel, now about to die, crossed his hands, and we'll see the blessing on his grandchildren, the two sons of Joseph, not of these other boys, and he said, "Let my name be named on them." And so the house of Israel is Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh primarily. The name Israel belongs more to the children of Joseph, Ephraim, and Manasseh, as we will see later on, than it does to Reuben, Simeon, Gad, Asher, any of the others that we could mention, Dan, Naphtali, Zebulun, and so on. Even though the promise of the Savior of the world was to come through Judah, and the scepter shall not depart from Judah, as we're going to see a little bit later on, the promise of race of multiple kings and of a company of nations and a great single nation was to be fulfilled in the children of Joseph. Now you stop to think of how God was allowing these human beings with their carnal hatreds, jealousies, their desire for profit, deliberately selling a half-brother into slavery, and yet it all worked out God's plan and God's purpose. Now you have to ask, what would it have been like for Joseph if he had not been sold into Egypt and was not later on the actual ruler of Egypt, as we're going to see, and later on became the protector of his own family, was like a great king in the nation, and also the fact that Israel was preserved, grew to be a great massive number of at least maybe 3 million people. That could not have happened in the land of Palestine in that day in the same way when it was allowed to happen in Egypt because of a great drought that was going to come. And we'll see that a little bit later on. So, with a foreknowledge, whether it was cyclical type weather, whether it was something God allowed to happen, whether Satan the devil even controlled a part of it, because Satan the devil can intervene in the weather. We saw that in the book of Job, where he caused a hurricane and he's called the prince of the power of the air. We know that Satan the devil can actually use the elements of wind and of storms to discomfort human beings. But you see that God allows raw, carnal, rotten human nature, every evil pull of the flesh, to actually work out his plan in spite of these people. So you have to imagine what would life have been like with young Joseph, 17, with all of these brothers that absolutely hated him for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years until his father is about to die and pronounces the blessing upon him. They probably would have attempted to kill him time and time and time again. So instead of that, God simply allowed their own evil plotting to just pull him completely away from the family, take him down to Egypt, and put him in a place where his life was preserved, and where he became, later on, the preserver of his family's life. They took the coat back, showed it to old, elderly Jacob, or Israel. Verse 34, he rent his clothes, that's a sign of great anguish, and put sackcloth upon his loins, and mourned for his son many days. And all of his sons and all of his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted, and he said, I will go down into the grave unto my son mourning. Now, it's noticed that it says all of his sons and what? All of his daughters. Just an interesting point in passing. To this point, you've never seen anybody except Dinah, who was mentioned among all the children, who were mostly male. But now there is proof that of these four women, and maybe other concubines that aren't mentioned, he must have had several female children as well. It says all of his sons and all of his daughters. And they're not named in the Bible. Thus his father wept for him. The Midianites sold him into Egypt unto Potiphar, the officer of Pharaoh's, and he is a eunuch, by the way, the eunuch of Pharaoh, and the captain of the guard. And that was pretty much always so. Those ancient kings did that because they were a little bit afraid of the power of the captain of the guard, and especially since he was also the keeper of the harem. And so the king wouldn't have to worry about it one way or another. They nearly always made him a eunuch. Now, I'm beginning to wonder, was he a true eunuch? And if so, why in the world was he married? Or was he definitely a eunuch and the marriage was simply a marriage of convenience and so on? And was that the reason why? We'll see what happened later on as we get into the story. It came to pass at that time. Now we're going to see something very interesting. God was not going to allow the progeny of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and now, of course, Judah, the son of Jacob, through whom the lineage was to come down to Jesus Christ of Nazareth, to be polluted by the Canaanites. It was one thing for Moses to marry a Midianite. It was quite a different thing for Judah to marry a Canaanite. Now let's look what happens, of how God allows this to happen. And even though it is an evil thing, even though all sorts of sins occur that never should have happened in one sense of the word, God is not actively interfering or intervening. Remember that this is long, long prior to the codification of the laws at Mount Sinai. There is no Levitical priesthood. There is no system of government in this tribal, nomadic, goat herd, sheep herd, horse and camel herding society where there is some administrator of the law. If you break a law, it's between you and the other guy. If you form a pact or a covenant, it's between you and him, your herders and his herders. We've seen that time and time again. It was a rural, a completely agrarian, tent camp type of an environment, and the laws were sort of made as you go along between people. So even though we see open harlotry, and we see a person actually commanding another person to take a kid of the flock and to go pay the harlot, we don't see anybody coming along with an armed guard and saying, hey, wait a minute, that's against the law. We're going to stone you to death. No, the heads of these groups of sheep herders were like tribal princes, and they pretty much set their own laws as they went along. It came to pass at that time that Judah went down from his brethren and turned into a certain Adullamite whose name was Hirah. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua. I want to show you a little lesson here with regard to the use of the pronouns and the way the Bible can sometimes be misunderstood. If you read that at first, you'll read, and Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite whose name was Shua, meaning the daughter's name was Shua. You can almost read it that way if you're not careful. But it isn't that. If you look at verse 12, in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And so it doesn't name the woman. Shua is the name of the man, and it's the man's daughter. The man's name is Shua. The man's daughter, who Judah married, is not named. And he took her and went in under her, and she conceived and bare a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bare a son, and she called his name Onan. Now, both of those names are apparently Canaanitish names. They do not contain any reference to the name of God, as do many of the other names that we'll see a little later on. And remember that the mother was pagan. She was Canaanitish, and therefore would have been polytheistic and pagan in her worship. And she yet again conceived and bare a son, and called his name Shelah. And he was at Kizib when she bare him, and Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, whose name was Tamar. Tamar means a very pleasant palm tree, or a palm grove, apparently, and is a very nice-sounding name. And Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal slew him. The only thing it says about him, you can look up all the Bible books you want to, you won't get any other information, this is all there is. We don't have any idea of exactly what he did, what his wickedness consisted of, but certainly if his mother was Canaanitish, there must have been something that was not discovered or found out until the time of the marriage. And it must have had something to do with the customs that he was observing. What it was, we don't know. But he was wicked in the sight of the Eternal slew him. One might suspect some sort of a perversion or something. So how God killed him, whether he just stopped his heart, whether he was afflicted with a disease, whether he toppled over of a sort of a heart attack, we don't have any clue. And Judah said unto Onan, go in unto your brother's wife and marry her and raise up seed to your brother. Now this was not yet codified, though later on under the Levitical priesthood it was. It became a law in ancient Israel, and the purpose of that law was that so no name died out. If a man had two or three sons, there were younger sons, the elder son married a woman, he died having conceived no seed, had no son to carry on that name, then by law in the Old Testament, the next in line had no choice about who he was going to marry. He had to marry his widowed brother's wife. He had to marry her so that his name was the same name as the brother would have been, and that name would not perish from Israel. And of course, that was done, no doubt, in many, many cases. In this case, though it was perhaps imposed only by Judah or by aged old Israel, and not by any constituted authority other than just the tribal patriarchs, there was no system of law which was going to enforce it. It was generally going to be enforced by these patriarchal tribal leaders. So Onan knew that the seed should not be his. It would not be counted as his own heir. He was like a surrogate father in that sense then. And it was not like it was his, and even any kind of birthright, any kind of inheritance, any kind of passing down of family heirlooms or of lands or of herds or personal jewelry, whatever a person would accumulate at that day and age, would not really be considered his, but would have been his older brother's, Ur's. So because Onan knew this, came to pass, when it went in unto his brother's wife, that he spilled it on the ground. And that's simply interrupting. We won't go into a lot of clinical detail on that. And from this comes a complete, totally perverted, misunderstood idea in the minds of a lot of young people. And it's passed on high school playgrounds and locker rooms, and people will absolutely stand up and virtually swear that there is a scripture in the Bible that says, quote, well, let me shock you, but it is better to sow one seed in the belly of a whore than to spill it on the ground, end of quote. And by that so-called scripture, many people have justified the idea of harlotry or of prostitution. No such scripture is in the Bible from Genesis to Revelation. I once had a guy that was really going to argue with me on the question, handed him a Bible, and he paged back and forth. Well, I know what's in there. I mean, he was willing to swear on his mother's grave and a stack of Bibles, and he said, I have seen it with my own eyes. Well, at some point in time, years before, somebody might have showed him this. He might have seen this scripture. This is the only reference to anything like that in the Bible anyway. It has nothing to do with harlotry. Has nothing to do with the justification of it. It has only to do with the fact that the man refused to raise up seed unto his own brother. And so, of course, God was displeased, and he slew him also. Verse 10. Now, both of these young men were Canaanites. And here was Tamar, who apparently was, I don't know whether she was a Midianite or what she was, but I doubt very much if she was Canaanitish. And if she was, fine, but in any event, God was not going to allow these two young men, for some reason, Ur and Onan, to continue the lineage, and we can read as we'll go along, and we know that Perez and Zerah are going to be born fairly soon, and they are the children of an incestuous or a semi-incestuous relationship, as we will see, when Tamar poses as a prostitute, and Judah, her own father-in-law, is actually the progenitor or the father, eventually, of her two children, her twins. So, then said Judah to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, remain a widow at your father's house till Shelah, my son, be grown, for he said, lest peradventure he die also as his brethren did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. And in process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. Judah's wife is not named. And Judah was comforted, meaning he mourned, and then a little while he got over it, and went up unto his sheep shearers in Timnath, he and his friend Hira the Adullamite. I guess they would shear the sheep very likely in the spring, the very, very early spring, just as winter is past and the weather is warming. And, of course, it was an annual occasion at the sheep shearing. It took an awful lot of work. And it was told Tamar, saying, behold, your father-in-law goes up to Timnath to shear his sheep. And she put her widow's garments off from her and covered her with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place. It's fascinating to me to find that in this chapter of the Bible here, the women were obviously going with their faces exposed. And that in order to masquerade as a harlot, they covered the face. And where you have that completely perverted and twisted around in all Arab societies today. Now, it's not practiced very much in Egypt, and it's not practiced in many of the Middle Eastern countries, except just some few. It's quite rigidly adhered to in some of the cities, especially in Mecca, Medina, and some of the others, though not the capital city of Saudi Arabia. And they're trying to enforce it a little more in Iran. Iran is not an Arabic country, by the way. They are Muslim in religion, but they're Turkomanish people, the same type of people as the Kurds and the Turks and some of the others of the steppes of the White Russian plains. And they are dark, oftentimes, and swarthy, but they have a completely different racial background than the Arabic stock, such as the Palestinians and the Saudi Arabians and the Jordanians and the Hashemites and others. So, here, she put her widow's garments off from her and covered her with a veil and wrapped herself and sat in an open place, which is, by the way, to Timnath, for she saw that Shelah was grown and was not given into wife. Now, apparently, Judah had changed his mind by now. And why it was that God had singled out Tamar to actually continue that lineage, I don't know, but there it is, he had. He was going to allow it to happen. Allow human artifice, human nature, human sins, if you will, to actually work out his plan. But he was not about to have either Ur or Onan be the fathers of some of the lineage that would eventually come on down through the biblical genealogies we can read in the Gospels, a couple of accounts, which would result finally in Christ. Now, Christ is, of course, only in a sense technically of that lineage because Joseph was not his true father. But the lineage was to come down at least to the foster father, if you will put it like that. And Mary was a very close member of the same family, but it didn't come down to the daughter, you'll notice. It came down to Joseph, and then, of course, it came down to Jesus Christ. When Judah saw her, he thought her to be a harlot because she had covered her face. Now, he's been without a wife for some time and probably still quite a powerful man. He turned in unto her by the way, and said, Go on, or go to, I pray thee, and let me come in unto thee, for he knew not that she was his daughter-in-law. And she said, What wilt thou give me, that thou mayest come in unto me? And he said, I will send thee a kid from the flock. And she said, Will you give me a pledge, till you send it? And he said, What pledge will I give you? And she said, Your signet, that was a ring with probably a seal of some sort on it, which was used in pressing into clay, or used in act. Apparently were made out of almost like the wampum that the Indians did, because the meaning of the Hebrew word is like cords, rather than necessarily metal. So it might have been a braided type of bracelet with little beads on it or something like that involving cloth, but that's not clear. And the staff that is in your hand. And he gave it to her and came in unto her, and she conceived by him. And she arose and went away and laid her veil from her and put on the garments of her widowhood. And Judah sent the kid by the hand of his friend, the Abdulamite. Isn't that amazing? Just right out in the open, he goes back and he tells his close friend and almost a compatriot there, another herdsman, oh, by the way, I owe a whore, a kid, and will you please take it over there and give it to her? Just amazing that the society was run that way at that time. His friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand, and he found her not. And he asked the men of the place, saying, Where is the harlot that was openly by the wayside? And they all knew, of course, that if a woman went out and sat by the road where men went by and had a veil over her face, she's a hustler. She's working as a harlot. And nobody got excited about it. The law didn't show up. It's just amazing when you look at the kind of a society it was. And they said there was no harlot in this place because she was only there for a short while until Judah came by and then, of course, immediately changed her disguise and went back to her widow's mourning clothes. He returned to Judah and said, I cannot find her. And also the men of the place said, there was no harlot in this place. And Judah said, Let her take it to her, lest we be shamed. Behold, I sent this kid, and you have not found her. And it came to pass about 3 months later that it was told Judah, saying, Behold, you know, Tamar, your daughter. Now look at the incredible hypocrisy of this man. Unbelievable hypocrisy of this man. Tamar, your daughter-in-law, has played the harlot, and also, behold, she is with child by whoredom. And Judah said, Bring her forth and let her be burnt. Unbelievable hypocrisy. I find a great human lesson in that. First place, don't let her be stoned, not disowned or put out or ostracized or sent away to another land, and not even death by stoning, which is a horrible, cruel death, but burn her at the stake. Interesting, isn't it? That sometimes when people's own guilt come back on their heads, and they have been guilty of the same sin, that they can get more viciously outraged, more angry, more venomously and hideously mad of wanting to heap some kind of punishment on some other person who has committed the same sin. Why? Because that person standing there having committed that same sin is an ugly reminder of their own guilt, and they just can't stand it. They just can't live with it. So you'll find it's sort of a principle that instead of dispensing mercy, instead of saying, well, the poor dear, the poor girl, mercy, look what she must have gone through, look at the agony of these 3 months of knowing she was expecting, not being able to tell anybody, for pity's sake, who is the father, oh, it's horrible, how she must have suffered, what are we going to do now, how are we going to get this right, how are we going to make it good, she ought to be able to be forgiven, you know what, I mean, just thinking mercifully, thinking the way Christ did when the woman who was taken in the very act of adultery was brought to him in the temple, and he said, Neither do I condemn thee, go and sin no more. But not Judah. Judah was completely carnal. Just because his name is Judah and he's the progenitor of the Jewish race does not mean that he was basically a good man. And he certainly was a very, very carnal and a very hypocritical man. So he said, Bring her forth and let her be burnt. When she was brought forth, she sent to her father-in-law, saying, By the man whose these are, am I with child? And she said, Discern, I pray thee, whose are these, the signet and bracelets and staff? And Judah acknowledged them and said, She has been more righteous than I, because that I gave her not to Shelah my son, and he knew her again no more. If that's some sort of a repentance, well, that's good. But at least he did acknowledge it. He came to himself. He said, She is a better person than I am. She's a more righteous person than I am. I am not as righteous as she is. And of course, exonerated her completely, and there was no more talk of any burning. It came to pass in the time of her travail that, behold, twins were in her womb. And it came to pass that when she travailed, one put out his hand. And the midwife took and bound upon his hand a scarlet thread, saying, this came out first. Why? Well, because under the laws of these tribal societies, the right of the firstborn was very, very important. It also was ingrained in them with regard to the fact that the firstlings, or the first fruits of everything that they raise in terms of their flocks and herds, or even the first fruits that came from their vegetables, or their grains, or their root crops, or their permanent crops, such as orchards, belonged to God, and that they gave an offering of that. And the firstborn was looked as sanctified unto God for God's calling and purpose and for the continuation of the lineage. And of course, they knew very greatly, because it had been repeated to them countless times, about the promises to their grandfather, their great-grandfather, the promise from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and right on down, that kings and nations and great races of people are going to come out of thee. So any handmaiden, when one in this lineage was going to have a child, would have been very careful to make sure which one was the firstborn. It came to pass that as he drew back his hand, behold, his brother came out. I guess that could happen, and it did happen. I don't guess. It did happen, but it's certainly not going to happen very often. And she said, how hast thou broken forth? This breach be upon thee. Therefore his name was called Breach. Phares, that's what it means. Imagine a guy whose name was Breach Judson, made Judason, or Breach Judson was probably his name later on. Now, they call his name Phares, but of course Phares is a Hebrew name, and if we said it in the English name, it would be Breach. And afterward came out his brother that had the scarlet thread upon his hand, and his name was called Zerah. Well, I'm going to stop right there. We're getting out of the story of Joseph next time. We've got about 8 minutes here before the hour, and we'll adjourn for a few minutes, unless there's one quick question. Anybody got one quick question that I can't see? I don't see any hands anywhere. Okay, let's have an intermission for a little while then.